Hi, everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the Geek Show's dedicated books and arts and everything else show. We have all sorts of things to talk about today, including a very, very, very interesting book later on. But before all that, my name is Rob, and I am joined by the wonderful Andrew.
Hello.
How are you today?
I am relatively okay in the grand scheme of things.
Aside from not being allowed to film stuff yesterday.
Yes, aside from not being allowed to film things, even though that was my sole purpose for being there.
It sounds like you were not even going to say not going there.
Well, I'm just saying I was there to make sure the action got filmed, and the action did not get filmed. And now there's going to be lots of disappointed people.
Yes. Need more of those little blue pills. Anyway, yes, today we have all sorts of news. We're going to start off with... What are we starting off with?
We are starting off with something we mentioned last week. The Oxford Literary Festival are now going to consider paying their authors following the outcry last week of Philip Pullman resigning over it. So...
Well, he resigned as patron, didn't he?
Yes, he resigned as the patron of the festival over the fact that it refuses to pay its writers anything.
Okay. So have the Oxford Literary Festival made any changes to their policy now?
Well, not yet. Basically, there's been a huge thing. Novelist Amanda Craig has kind of written an open letter calling for people to start boycotting it.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's got a bunch of signed names, including Harris, Simon, John McGregor, and Linda Grant.
Wow.
So basically, that's kind of made the festival take notice, and they are they've put out an official statement saying that they recognise and understand the strength of feeling in the literary community regarding the payment of speaker fees to authors and writers, and we are sympathetic to the cause. And they basically now holding some sort of big meeting thing to work out the possibility of being able to pay all their speakers a fee.
See, if they just paid them from the beginning...
Yeah, then this wouldn't be a thing.
No, it wouldn't be. But having to work out... I mean, I'm sure at some point in the history of the festival, somebody said, we should pay the speakers. And somebody said... Somebody else has probably said, no, they won't notice.
Well, I feel like the general idea was it's some sort of weird, oh no, we shouldn't have to pay them for the privilege of getting to speak at our events type thing.
Yeah.
But I think Philip Pullman, he summed it up pretty well by basically just saying, no, what we're doing is work and we want to be paid for work.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, if you work, you deserve to be rewarded for that work. Doesn't matter what the work is. It could be sweeping streets. It could be, you know, cleaning windows, wherever. Work is work, and you should be paid for work, especially if you do good job. And if you do really good job, next time I'll give you a brush.
But it's more fun using my hands.
You got the reference then. I love that. I wanted to put that on a t-shirt. You know, you do good job, next time I give you brush. Yes, the International Space Station was never the same again.
Anyway, yeah. So hopefully this all gets resolved. I think the only thing I'm a bit worried at the moment is their use of things like, yes, we'll consider it and we'll talk about the possibility of paying fees.
Yeah.
That they seem to be dancing around it a bit.
Well, they don't want to admit that they're at fault. It's a standard kind of business practice, you know.
Oh, yeah, the I'm sorry you were offended type thing.
Yeah. I'm sorry you were offended. We didn't intentionally do this. It was never our intention to upset anybody.
Yeah, all that kind of stuff.
We apologize. We will pay people in future, but we're not going to pay anybody for previous work they've done.
Oh, no, I definitely can't see that happening.
And the reason why I can't see it happening is because business spin.
Exactly.
See, if they were being fair about it and they were going to be right about it, they would go back historically and pay the people who actually had spoken at the festival throughout the last however many years the festival's been running. That's if they were going to be fair and proper about it. But they won't, because it's a business.
Again, I guess it's kind of a jerky thing to do, but I can kind of see it as a, well, they already agreed to do it for free, therefore we don't have to pay them.
Yeah, that's my point. That's why I said if they were being fair and proper about it, they'd basically say, okay, we'll backdate it for everybody else, but they're a business, and that's how businesses run. That's how you make money in business, unfortunately, because nobody gets into business in order to be poor.
That is true. Unless you're in some kind of wacky scheme whereby you have to start a business to lose $1 million so that you can then later get $10 million.
Are we talking like a Brewster's Millions scenario?
Yes, we are exactly talking a Brewster's Millions scenario.
Do I have to be Richard Pryor again? I don't like being Richard Pryor. I don't like being Richard Pryor.
Well, tough. It's what you have to do if we're going to make this work.
Right, okay, then that means you have to be Gene Wilder.
Yes. You said that like I would have any problem with being Gene Wilder.
Okay. We'll move on to the next story. Well, Andrew just sits there going, oh, she, oh, she. And he's not meaning delicious. Right, Amy Tan is going to be honoured by the naming of a new species.
Wow, what proud noble animal is being named after this prestigious author?
Well, it's a leech. I don't know how to process this. She's being honoured by a leech, with a leech being named after her. Now,
I just love how happy she looks in the picture for the story.
Yeah, I know. She is really happy, and she's the author of best-selling books like The Bonesetter's Daughter and The Joy Luck Club. And she's just had a species of leech named after her. The Chaton... You chose... this is purposeful, you know.
I did. I finally thrown a complicated name back at you.
The Ktonobdella Tanai.
Yeah, it's like a C, an H, and then a T.
I don't know how to pronounce that. If it was TCH, I'd know. It's
yeah. So it's like... Chitonobdella
Tanai is a tiny Australian leech, and it, according to researchers who announced its name or tried to announce its name, it's the first new species of invertebrate without chitinous or calcified tissue, which is like a shell or exoskeleton, which has been described with computed tomography scanning or CT scanning. According to Mark Siddle, I'm still trying to get my mouth around that Chitonobdella Tanai thing. According to Max Siddle, who's the creator of invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History, don't you start laughing.
Absolute serious deadpan.
Tan has accompanied Mark Siddle.
It's got all the words have gone.
All the words have gone because of that. Right, starting from the beginning. Mark, look. Amy Tan has accompanied, in the past, right, Amy Tan's accompanied Mark Siddle, who's the creator of the invertebrate zoology, who's the curator of invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. She's gone with him into the field in the past, and he said that she was a longtime supporter of the work they do at the American Museum of Natural History. And she's also someone they knew would consider it an honor, not an insult, to have a leech named after her. Tan mentions jungle leeches several times in her hilarious novel Saving Fish from Drowning, and the author said that she was thrilled to be immortalized with the naming of the leech. This humble leech has looped across a new scientific threshold, the first microscopic soft-bodied critter to be described inside and out using CT scanning. Imagine the possibilities for identifying legions of tiny organisms that have thus far lived in obscurity. So, yeah, I'm going to leave that story there while I recover from Chitonobdella Tanai.
It's pretty much the only word in your mouth.
Do you know what the sad part is? It's pretty much the only word I can say correctly at this moment in time. Everything else is gone.
You've sacrificed everything for that one name.
Exactly. I have to take some time out to kind of recover now, so it's your turn.
Okay, let's move on to fairy tales, which apparently might be much older than previously thought, according to scientisty types.
Please have horrible names. Please have horrible names. Make him pronounce something bad.
So basically, fairy tales like Beauty and the Beast and Rumpelstiltskin, which were originally thought to be from like the 15th, 16th century.
Yeah.
May actually date back to the Bronze Age.
Really?
Yeah. Basically, using techniques normally employed by biologists, the study has found common links between 275 Indo-European fairy tales from around the world, and found some have roots that are far older than previously known and long before the emergence of literary record.
Well, that does make sense to a degree, because it would explain why you get elf-like characters all over the world, yeah, why you get fairy-type characters all over the world, why you get dragons everywhere. Literally, there are stories of dragons in every single culture, going back throughout history.
Yeah, and lots of common story elements, like, you know, brave princes rescuing damsels in distress, all that.
Giants.
Yeah,
giants are everywhere. Every culture has a story about giants. Actually, that's actually the truth. Every single culture in history has a story about giants, at least one.
Yeah, that'll make a lot more sense that they come from this one common source.
Yeah. You know, the whole thing about vampires and everything like that. Or the old style, not the stalker vampires. I'm talking about the really old ones.
Yeah, yeah, like the creatures of the night.
Well, the thief of dreams, that sort of thing. You know, they come in the night because the night time is when people are asleep and they can feed off the energy of people. So, yeah, vampires.
Here's the interesting thing, though. Apparently, in the 19th century, Wilhelm Grimm of the Brothers Grimm,
yeah,
actually believed that all these stories came from this one common cultural history dating back to the birth of the Indo-European language. But it was actually later thinkers who, like, poo-pooed that idea. Because when you're a stuffy shirt scientist, you do poo-poo things.
Yes, you do.
And they're the ones who kind of got this idea that it's like from the 15th, 16th, 17th century.
Yeah, but to be honest, I've long thought that fairy tales go back further. And the main reason I've thought that is because a lot of these fairy tales have parallels with old Indian myths. And those myths have been proven to go back 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. The Ramayana, for example, how old is that? That's not a modern story. That story goes back about 3,000 years. The story of Rama and Sita.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of stuff. You know, that goes back like 3,000 years. India is, around 2,500, 3,000 years old, isn't it?
I think it's probably, especially in like the 19th century, it's very much obviously these are something we must have come up with.
Yeah.
Like, we can't even entertain the idea that another culture has inspired ours.
Yeah.
Curry is a completely British invention, just like Chinese food.
Actually, it's the truth that curry is a completely British invention, because they don't call it curry.
We are culinary masters.
Well, they don't call it curry in India.
Did they just call it food?
Yeah, basically. And this whole thing, you know, the korma, right? When I make a traditional korma, it doesn't have that much coconut in. It has, and it certainly doesn't have nuts and raisins in. Or cream. It's a lot spicier than the korma you get here.
Yeah, but I think our sensitive British palates need something a lot calmer.
That's why it's called a korma,
exactly.
Is it?
See what I did?
Yes, I saw. But yeah, sensitive British palates aside, I like the fact that all the sportsmen, all the jocks, try and prove how tough they are by having a foul. It's called a foul for a reason. Because some part of you will fall out after you've eaten one.
Is that the one you see?
That's basically the noise that people make.
Goes red,
no, that's
the eyes glaze over.
That's the noise that people make when they're eating one. That is exactly the noise that people make.
Well, at least it's a straightforward
it's the sound,
naming
it's the
scheme.
Sound of your soul escaping.
As it's slowly incinerated.
No, after you've been violated violently by food. Anyway, how'd we get onto this? We were talking about, what were we talking about again?
Fairy tales and how
that's
they're older
it.
Than
that's it. Anyway, yes, fairy tales. Yeah, I believe that they are a lot older than people think. Because at the end of the day, you can't go around inventing a pantheon of gods without having a bunch of fairy tales to go with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and plus, it's people like to tell stories. It's like inherent to the human condition.
Well, it was.
So, of course, like, since there's been humans, there's going to be these stories.
It wasn't just that. I mean, the main purpose of fairy tales, and the Grimms were right about one thing when they got right down to it. The main purpose of fairy tales was that they were teaching stories. And yes, they evolve over time. But when you want to teach a lesson, you generally tell a story, don't you? You don't just say to a kid, don't do this, because they'll go ahead and do it.
Yeah, yeah. You would say, don't take biscuits from the biscuit jar, or Cluatu, the biscuit demon, will drag you down to hell.
Yeah, he'll pull you into the jar and you'll never escape. And you'll be turned into a biscuit.
Turn your face into a biscuit.
Yeah, no, you'll be turned into a biscuit and then you might get dunked in tea and eaten by your dad. Because kids only respond to really gruesome threats. You know, if you tell a kid that he shouldn't touch something, he'll get, you know, he'll get a smack if he touches something. He's going to touch it. But if you tell a kid that you're going to tie his arms in a knot behind his head if he touches it,
then he's not going to touch it.
Nope. He's going to go, can my arms do that? And he's going to be more interested in finding out if his arms can be tied into a knot behind his head. And he'll sit there with his arms going, how does it work? He's forgotten about what you told him not to touch. He's more interested in that. Or she. Or she. We are an equal opportunity society now.
I disagree, but I remember the many hours spent trying to get one leg behind my head.
I don't want to know why.
To see if I could, Rob.
You'd seen it in a yoga video, hadn't you? You thought, I wonder.
And then there's that awkward popping sound, and you decide it's about time to stop.
Yeah, because the pain. Rather, it's not that you've decided it's a good time to stop, it's just that, you know, your body and your brain have both gone, they're both kind of flowed away. And you wake up in the, you know, in the hospital with a mass of ice around your hip. You're like, what happened? Anyway, before we float off into the distance again. But yeah, fairy tales, teaching stories. I mean, you look at all of these fairy tales, even the ones that the Grimms did, and all of them have that moral thing. Or that thing where you're not supposed to do this, or don't do this because this is what happens, or don't be like this because this is what could happen. That's the core of fairy tales. I mean, you have, with the North American Indians, you had all sorts of stories about, you know, their ancestors and stuff like that. With the Aboriginal tribes, you have all sorts of stories from the Dreamtime. With the Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians, you had all sorts of stories, you know, about the gods and everything like that. And the same with the Greeks.
Yeah, well, I think, and that's the other thing that fairy tales are good for, is just explaining things we don't understand.
Yeah, yeah. Phenomena we don't understand, and at some point those fairy tales turn into religions.
Yeah, and then it gets boring, because that's all just Gibson's there because God put it there.
See, I like...
It's like good old Helios and his chariot of goats pulling the sun across the sky.
See, I like the whole thing with thunder and lightning. It's... You know, I like the Greek version where it's just basically, oh, yeah, there's lightning. Ah, Zeus is a bit angry again, is he? Like, yeah. He should just turn into a gust of wind and go out and get laid again. Because that was the bit that I didn't understand about Greek mythology. It's like, okay, you're very advanced in certain ways, but you believe that the father of the gods committed patricide and split the world up between him and his two brothers, and can throw lightning about, but got a woman pregnant by once turning into a swan, I think once turning into a bull, and once turning into a gust of wind.
Which could almost be just like the best excuse for any woman who cheats on their partner in ancient Greece.
It was
Zeus. Doesn't look like you. That gust of wind.
Exactly.
Zeus.
Basically. So, yeah. I reckon that's what it was.
So we've cracked all of Greek mythology
and fairy tales at the same time. Good job. So is it my turn next?
Yeah, it's your turn now.
Right, actually continuing a little bit on the fairy tales theme, this headline says no trolls allowed, but I know what it's for. The city of Seattle is seeking a writer for a unique residency. They want a writer to live and work, or to work, in one of the towers of its Fremont Bridge, which crosses the Lake Washington Ship Canal. The selected writer, who could be a poet, fiction or creative non-fiction author, will receive $10,000 or £7,000 to work in the space for 3 months. So it is work then. To work in the space for 3 months and is expected to undertake an in-depth exploration of the bridge and write a literary response to the experience to coincide with the 100th birthday of the structure in 2017. The residency will occupy the northwestern tower of the bridge, a room measuring 13 feet by 8 feet, with a 10-foot ceiling and a stairway coming up through the space. It's furnished with a desk, chair, overhead lights, windows and an air conditioning unit, and the space has no toilet, kitchen or running water. Yes.
I'm not sure it's worth the money.
£7,000 for 3 months.
Yeah, but that's 3 months with, like, no toilet, no kitchen. Although I guess, they don't have anyone watching you live in there, do they? So you could always just, like, sneak out.
It's over a river. Make a little hatch for yourself.
What, just, like, jet ski at the bottom?
Yes. No, you just make a little hatch for yourself and then squat over it.
I was thinking just, like, sneak off to a hotel or something, but...
Oh, no, you're only working there, so you don't have to be there all day for a start. And I'm sure there's somewhere close by that has a toilet.
Yeah, that's true. No, okay, just right. I'll accept the offer.
But if it's this tower that I'm seeing in this article in front of me, you could literally put a hatch there.
Oh my God, you could. So it's just hanging right over the river.
Oh, that would be bad. Where are all the fish gathering? And now you know why they tell you to remove the fish guts.
Wow. This story's taking a disgusting turn.
I know.
Get it? Because a tern is a fish, Rob.
No, it's a bird.
Wait. Chow. Screw it. Forget all of it. Got it all. It's all ruined.
And I'm supposed to be the tired one. I'm the one who can't get words out because words are hard.
Yeah, but that's not tiredness. That's because you've been broken by a leech.
By Chitunabdella. It's still the only thing I can say.
Like, you realize now you're going to go to a shop and you won't be able to say the word crisps.
Can I have
and
a packet
have
of Chitunabdella? Well, I'll go for a burger. I would like a quarter Chitunabdella and cheese, please.
Make it extra squishy.
Yes. Anyway. So, yeah. There is the artist's residency position in a tower on a bridge. No running water, no kitchen, no toilet. £7,000 for 3 months. It's £2,000 a month. It's not bad.
That's not too shabby at all.
And if you put it out over a year, that's 28,000 a year. That's more than a lot of writers make.
Yeah. Plus, I guess if you just, like, bash out the book in, like, the first month or whatever, 2 months just chilling in a box.
Yes. Invite your friends over. Hook up a PlayStation 4 or something like that. Can you imagine?
Wait, didn't you say it has no electricity, though?
Get a generator.
It's true, you can.
Yeah, you can buy a generator. If you're getting £2,000 a month, you could surely spend £300 on a small generator that would be enough to power a PlayStation 4 and a little flat screen TV.
Yeah, boom, there we go. If anyone's interested, free party times.
Yes.
Just send us an invite.
Anyway, right, moving on to, I think, the final news story, isn't it?
Yes. So, basically, a few months ago... Oh, no, in fact, earlier this month, Mexican drug lord Joaquin Guzman, also known as El Chapo, which
yes.
is not intimidating.
No. <know. laughs> See, I know why they've called him El Chapo, but here in the UK, when we say El Chapo, we're talking about something completely different. My name is El Chapo. And I live for pleasure.
Be careful, El Chapo is armed and dangerous.
Yes. He's wearing his ridged armour.
Oh, okay, so yeah, like I said, he's been recaptured by Mexican authorities. But, oh no, Rob, after all his time on the run, he's tired and a bit depressed.
Just a bit?
Just a little bit. But don't worry, Mexican prison officials have worked out a solution.
Okay.
They've given him a copy of Don Quixote to read.
Of all the books to give someone who's depressed?
Yeah.
See, if someone's depressed, you don't give them Don Quixote. Because, well, we're still not sure if he was actually mad or not. Let's put it that way.
No, I just love the absolute simplicity of the reason they've given.
Oh?
It's just because we believe it is an excellent book and we have to start giving him such notions.
Hang on, is there a punishment game going on here? Did he lose a bet or something like that? Didn't they have a bet with the guards? And or an argument with the prison warden, who might be a massive Don Quixote fan, has a picture of what's his name? Oh, I've forgotten his name. Was in Third Rock from the Sun, and the old guy from Third Rock from
John
the
Lithgow.
Sun. John Lithgow. John Lithgow has a picture of John Lithgow as Don Quixote, you know, wearing the rustbot armor, stuff like that. Has a picture of him on the wall, and he's a massive Don Quixote fan and a massive John Lithgow fan, and had an argument with El Chapo.
See, no, I just like
and El Chapo
like,
says Don Quixote is not good.
Maybe the prison warden is like just super BFFs with him. It's just like, El Chapo, you're back. Oh my God, I've read the best book. You totes have to read it.
That is also that option. So we have two options. Fly on the wall camera, please. We need the truth.
This is literally the only thing we need to learn from Mexican prisons.
Yes. And hopefully Mel Gibson was not involved in any way. I saw Get the Gringo. Oh, what was it?
Yeah, I think it was Get the Gringo. I think here it was How I Spent My Summer Vacation.
Yeah, because the highly insulting Get the Gringo apparently was not a title they wanted to use.
Oh, but I like the idea of everyone else being racist towards Mel Gibson.
Yeah, makes a nice change.
That's called irony.
Yes, nothing to do with breasts and claws. Let us remind our American audience of that. Anyway, so, El Chapo has Don Quixote. What did he think of it?
I think he has not started reading it yet. But I'm sure that one day we will see his review online.
Anyway, I think that's enough for the news for today.
Yeah,
let's take a quick break there so we can recover and I can try and recover my wordage. And then we'll move on to our book of the day.
TV. There's a lot of TV, even the internet is TV these days. And if there's too much out there to know what to watch and what not to watch, well, tune in to the Geek Show Podcast Network's very own TV show, On The Box.
Welcome back to Literary Loitering here on the Geek Show Podcast Network. Now it is time for our Book of the Week. And this week we have one from Rob.
Yes, and this one is from Corky. And it is, weirdly enough, a Pratchett book.
Oh, not weirdly. All books should be Pratchett books, except for the books that aren't.
Yeah.
And they're still good.
This is from the Corgi part of Penguin Random House, right? And this is for Diggers, which came out on the 21st of January 2016, and it's priced at $6.99. Now, for those of you who don't know, Pratchett obviously is most famous for Discworld. But a lot of people don't realize that way back in the day, Pratchett did a couple of extra books that weren't Discworld related.
Yes, the Bromeliad trilogy.
Yep. Well,
or the Gnome trilogy, if you're weird.
Yeah, I know. I don't know why they started calling it the Gnome trilogy, but it's not Gnome spelt G-N-O-M-E. It's Gnome spelt N-O-M-E.
Because that makes more sense.
Yes. Now, this is the second installment in the Bromeliad or the Gnome trilogy. It's the second book. And what's happened is that Arnold Brothers has basically been demolished by this point. But the gnomes have managed to escape. And they have escaped to a nearby quarry. And they're making their home there. Masquin has successfully saved his people from destruction. But the inside gnomes, as they were known, They're having some difficulty coping with the outside world, but they're learning to adapt as time goes by. Masklin is struggling with various things. He's trying to be the leader, but he's not sure how to be. And obviously, they've got this thing called Thing.
Which is a thing.
Yeah, it's a thing, and it talks every so often and gives them sage advice every so often. But Masklin, nobody's still sure what it is. Masklin's not sure what it is. But Masklin, Masklin and Grimmer have a kind of on-again, off-again relationship throughout the book. And it kind of falls apart a little bit during this when Grimmer tries to explain the whole idea of...
Yeah, that she doesn't want to be like a South American tree frog.
Yeah, she doesn't want to be like a South American tree frog. She basically wants to see the world, wants to experience the world. And Masklin can't understand that because he's a guy and she isn't. And obviously there's that whole thing where he's a guy. So obviously he doesn't get it. Just case in point, most guys do get it. We just actually don't care. Anyway, something happens with Thing. And Masklin has decided that they have to find a way to make life better for the gnomes. And so Masklin, Thing, and Abbot Gerda, and the character with the best name in any Pratchett book yes. I've ever read, Angelo de Haberdashery, they take the Thing with them to investigate the nearby airport, but they don't actually come back. So Grimmer has to take charge, and she has to deal with the rebellion from Abbot Gerda's apprentice, Nicodemus. But while this is all going on, and while Masklin has disappeared, the humans, who every gnome knows that humans aren't that smart, every gnome is smarter than a human. It's like common sense. Everybody knows this. The humans, in their stupidity, have decided to reopen the quarry. And so humans are starting to come back to the quarry. Grimmer and the rest of the gnomes, normally they would flee, but on this occasion, they basically say, hang on, why the hell should we run away? We were here first. We're going to fight back. So they start looking for ways of fighting back, and Dorcas, the engineer, finds in an old shed an old, abandoned, monstrous vehicle that he calls Jacob, or Jacob.
Because it's a JCB.
Yeah, he repairs it, and they use it to attack the humans, and basically, they use it to attack the humans and escape the quarry before the quarry is basically blown up and whatever, and vehicles around and the gnomes all die. And there's just this brilliant scene of the JCB plowing, carving its way across farmland, being chased by police cars,
yes.
while it's being driven by what looks like nobody at all. And then
I remember that one now.
It was just the most marvelous scene. It was just kind of, you got the gnomes all shouting at each other because they've all rigged up this, this pulley system, and everyone's trying to steer because the JCB has all these levers as well. So they're all trying to steer, and it's so much more complicated than the lorry that they used to escape to the quarry from Arnold Brothers, because that was fairly simple compared to the JCB.
And because you got all those you got big dicky claw thing to control as well.
There's so many handles, so many knobs, so many whistles, so many dials and stuff like that. And so there's all...
Which again, I know from my normal Saturday nights.
Yes. Isn't that your usual outfit? A couple of dials. lots of whistles, bells, knobs. And
the handles.
And handles, yes. Anyway, I'm not going to go into the whole story because this kind of runs parallel to the third book in the trilogy, which is Wings. And I'm not on about the Paul McCartney band.
No one ever is.
Diggers and Wings, they run parallel to each other because where Diggers deals with Grimmer and the rest of the gnomes in the quarry, Wings deals with what happened to Masklin. And the eventual destiny of the gnomes, which is a lot bigger than people think when you get right down to it. When they find out what Thing is and how Thing is important.
Yeah, it turns into this kind of like grand cosmic space opera.
Yeah, I know. It's weird how it works out. But yes, it also proves once and for all that gnomes are really smarter than humans. Because that's an ongoing thing in the book. In all three books, is that gnomes are smarter than humans. And then at the end of it, when you find out the truth,
the
about
gnomes
things,
really are smarter than humans.
Exactly. It's just kind of, all the signs were there. All the signs were there. But I've got to say, like truckers and like the carpet people, like the Johnny books, like Johnny and the Dead and Johnny and the Bomb, yeah, and Only You Can Save Mankind, and like the Amazing Maurice and his Educated Rodents, and like the Tiffany Aiken books, the We Three Men series, this is very much aimed at a younger audience. It's aimed at kids who are, you know, who are aged 7 and up, I suppose I'd say. I'd say 7 rather than 6, because 7 is more of a reading age. They're more familiar with, you know, reading more difficult words. I don't know.
I would say maybe more 8 and above.
I'm going by, you know, my own reading age. I started reading properly when I was like, you know, proper books when I was about 5 or 6, because we didn't have a TV, so that was the only match.
Yeah, but that's what I would say by not rob people, like 8 to 9 maybe.
8 to 9?
And above.
Okay, yeah, I can agree with that. So, yeah, Diggers, I'd say maybe 8 to 9 years old. But I've got to say, like Truckers, Diggers is a fun read. And like many of the Pratchett books, it is a fun ride as well. Not just a fun read, but a fun ride. And yes, I know. But Diggers is written in a much simpler style than some of Pratchett's other stuff. It's not heavy going. It's very straightforward. The story is very easy to follow. And it highlights one particular thing that I think is prominent in a lot of Pratchett's work, and that's that element of wonder. Because the gnomes have this kind of thing. They're in the outside world for the first time. They're adapting to the outside world for the first time. And then there's this element of wonder, which is why Grimmer brings up this whole idea of the tree frog. The only reason she knows about the tree frog is because of the book she read in the Arnold Brothers department store. But she never once thought that she would be outside. And now that she's outside, she feels a bit like that tree frog. But Masklin, because he's the leader and because he's got so much on his mind, he can't allow himself to have those kind of thoughts.
Yeah, you can't just say, oh, wow, look at this huge world we're in.
Yeah, he's too busy making sure that the people can eat, making sure that everybody has a roof over their heads, making sure that nobody gets seriously injured, stuff like that. His problems are a lot heavier than everyone else's, which is why he can't understand where she's coming from. It's not that she doesn't have her own work and doesn't try to help Masklin. It's just that because she has some time during the day when she can sit and just stare at the sky.
Yeah, well, I think it's because of the different viewpoints, where she sees some like new wonderful opportunity, he sees a bunch of potential problems.
Yeah, basically. But that's also why they work well together.
Yeah, they balance each other out.
Yep. Diggers, highly recommended. If you're a fan of Pratchett and you haven't read The Bromeliad, then shame on you.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure The Bromeliad was the first Pratchett thing I read.
The first one I read was The Colour of Magic. I actually read The Colour of Magic before I read The Bromeliad and The Carpet People and stuff like that. And it was, I think it was, I was about 6 books in to Pratchett. I can't remember which one the 6th book was. Was it Colour of Magic, like Fantastic, Equal Rights, Mort, Guards, and I can't remember what the 6th book was. Damn it. Was it Sorcery?
Yeah, I feel like Sorcery was...
No, it wasn't Sorcery. I think it was Pyramids or Small Gods, wasn't it? No, it was
Pyramids
Moving
is the
Pictures.
Seventh,
moving Pictures. Moving Pictures it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, that might have been the 6th one.
Yeah, I think Moving Pictures was the 6th one, because that was the one where you had, you know, Victor Tugelbend, can't sing, can't dance, can handle a sword a little. And the other one, you know, I come from a small town you'd never heard of. I just love his name, Victor Tugelbend.
That is like maybe the 2nd greatest Pratchett name.
Yeah, Angelo de Haberdashery, though, is the best name.
Yeah,
but,
well, hence why I said 2nd.
Yes, true. But yes, if you're a Pratchett fan and you haven't read The Bromeliad, you owe it to yourself to read The Bromeliad, because it is really, really good early Pratchett work. I mean, these were originally out in the 1990s. At the beginning of the 1990s, in fact. I think it was 1990 that Diggers and Wings came out, and it was, yeah, they were about 1 year apart. Truckers from 1989, Diggers in 1990, and Wings in 1990. And around that time, I think he also released The Carpet People as well, maybe a couple of years before, maybe a year after. but it was around that time. The Carpet People was an interesting one as well. And it
I feel like the Carpet People was a bit after.
Was it a bit after? It may have been a bit before. I don't know. I can't remember.
It was one of the two.
It was one of the two. It wasn't at the same time, I'm pretty sure of that. But the thing that I loved about the Carpet People was when I read it, because I'm fairly simple with a few things. I am fairly simple with a few things. And when I read the Carpet People, I was looking at the carpet going, I wonder. I literally was that. Anyway, I like Diggers. I like Diggers a lot. But then again, I'm a Terminal Pratchett fan, so I'm going to love it anyway. I honestly have not read a bad Terry Pratchett book.
Yes, I've got to. I don't think saying you like a Terry Pratchett book is going to shake the foundations of the show.
I know, but you understand what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I honestly have not read a bad Terry Pratchett book. Every Terry Pratchett book I've read, although it's varying degrees of how good they are, and there are some special, some that are just really enjoyable to read, but, you know, you wouldn't really go back to them. But the Bromeliad trilogy is one of those ones where I read it once and it stuck. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's one of those things you could probably only read once, but that's not out of a sense of not wanting to go back to it. It's because it made such an impression.
Yeah.
You don't need to read it again.
Exactly. And I think that, because it's like my niece, I got her to read The Wee Free Men when she was, I think, 10 years old. Got her to read The Wee Free Men. And it stuck with her. She was completely blown away by it. And she started asking me if I had the other books. I said, okay, here you go. Here's Winter Smith. Here's
I Shall Wear Midnight.
I Shall Wear Midnight here. What was the sequel to Wee Free Men? It was Hatful of Sky.
Yeah, Hatful of Sky.
Winter Smith and then I Shall Wear Midnight. And the last one was, obviously, The Shepherd's Crown. Yeah. But I basically got her to read the Tiffany Aching ones. And from there, she's branched out into some of the other Discworld stuff. But she loved it. She was blown away. And she rereads some of these books from time to time. But she has only read The Wee Free Men once. And even though she reads like A Hatful of Sky, and she's read A Hatful of Sky like 4 or 5 times now, because she loves A Hatful of Sky, but she's only read The Wee Free Men once. And the reason why she's only read it once is for that exact reason.
Yeah, it doesn't need reading again.
No. She found the concepts of it were just amazing, because she does martial arts, and so she's not in the mentality of being like the princess in the tower going, oh, save me, save me. So for
that's all about the Tiffany Aching series.
Yeah, so for her, Tiffany Aching was a highly relatable character. You know, she's quite inquisitive, is my niece, so she's always checking facts and stuff like that. So Tiffany Aching, when she reads about eyes the size of soup plates and she checks to see how big soup plates are and then goes, well, why couldn't they just say 10 centimeters? That kind of thing.
It's exactly that kind of inquisitiveness.
Yeah. So Diggers, highly recommended. If you haven't read it yet, read Truckers, get Diggers, get Wings, because they're really good.
Yes, yes, they are.
I have nothing else to add to this.
No, I think once again we shall end this show on the note that Terry Pratchett was a really great author and everyone should read his stuff.
Yes, I agree with this wholeheartedly.
Hey, we're done then.
Yes, we are done then.
Okay, yeah, that's the end of the show. You can find our show on Mixcloud, on Stitcher, on YouTube. We've got a DeviantArt. And, of course, we are online at geekshow.co.uk as long as the website is working.
It is, don't worry.
Hooray, the website is working, so you can find us there. And while you're there, shows like this, because we're a voluntary organisation, so we do rely on the support of our listeners. So if you feel like just throwing us a little bit of money, you can click the donate link on the right-hand side of the website, or you can visit our shop at The Geek Shop and buy lovely items of many different types, mostly t-shirts.
I should just clarify one thing. When we say throw some money at us, we don't mean if we're in the streets, start throwing pounds.
Yes, but don't actually pelt us with coins.
Yes,
that
please.
Hurts.
Yes, please don't do that.
That is how we've lost presenters in the past.
Yeah. No coin there.
No. Anyway, that's it from us. I've been Andrew.
I've been Rob.
And goodbye.
Thanks for listening.